Well, I'm sitting on this side, so I'm going to say it first. Welcome to La Cosa Nostra.
I'm Eddie.
I'm Noah.
Yeah, we're swapped swap places. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, you guys can't see this.
It's all
know if we
surreal. It's surreal.
Oh,
right
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe you'd hear us on the wrong side of your headphones or something.
Yeah.
hold on a minute. That's not right.
Is that how it works?
No.
Sometimes it does. I know. You wouldn't know.
I have no clue.
So today,
we're looking
1987.
Full Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
You know, the first Kubrick film, you know, hopefully first of many. You know,
I don't know, maybe.
You know, he's made a lot of good stuff. You know, we could get to The Shining, you know. And if we're feeling philosophical, we can get 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know. But we're talking about Full Metal Jacket today. So, when was the first time you saw Full Metal Jacket?
Literally yesterday. Well, only yesterday and the day before.
Yeah.
Wasn't actually the episode we had planned. It was just a weird coincidence.
I know. Okay. Why did you watch it? Let's do this. Why did you watch it?
It was on Netflix.
Oh, my God.
And it's one of those movies where you're like, yeah, I should watch it. And for those who don't know, Netflix is notorious for like, we've got exactly the movie you want, but for a total of like 3 hours, and then it's just disappeared.
Yeah. It's crazy. This was the exact same thing. This was the exact same thing that happened with me. I just saw this movie on Netflix and I'm like, okay, it's Full Metal Jacket. At some point, I'm going to have to get to this. And it looked really cool. I was like,
The cover is like, awesome.
I know. Like, there's a reason why, like, last week I put the movie's poster in my room. It is.
I thought it was an anime the first time I ever saw the poster.
What
is like Gear Metal Solid or something?
Metal Gear
Solid. It sounds the same.
Yeah.
And I think I saw somewhere maybe there is an anime version of the film. I was like, oh, it's an anime. Maybe I'll get around to it, like, if I really feel like it, but I probably won't. Little did I know, having seen The Shining about a year ago, that Kubrick had made a Vietnam movie. Although, it's not really a Vietnam movie to me.
This isn't like Apocalypse Now, where it's all of Asia showing, like, the horror of wars happening in Vietnam. This half of it is a movie about adrenaline structure who's really in your face. So, the big thing with this movie is that everybody's always like, and this isn't my opinion, well, it is, but it's not like, this is just a general opinion, that the first half is amazing, the second half, not so much. What do you think?
Well, I enjoy the first half, but I just felt like something was slightly off the whole time. And then watching the second half, as someone who, you know, somewhat enjoyed Good Morning Vietnam, which was kind of my only other experience in Vietnam on screen, I did really enjoy the second half. I thought Joker's a lot funnier, which kind of pleases his character. I love the idea of the peace and the born to kill symbol and the duality of man.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I just like the fact, I like Joker's
I just like the bit where it's like, Private Joker has the born to kill sign on his hand. And I think like the reporter or the army.
Yeah, the coach goes like, Private, what do you think you're doing? Is that a peace sign on your jacket? And he's like, Yes, sir, it is. And
he goes, then why do you have born to kill?
Why do you kill? He's like, I don't know, sir. And he's like, well, you don't know much. And he goes, the private was, I like just how the way they like, he takes like the mick out of the way they talk. Like he's just like completely like, he's taking the piss, but they just don't know it. And he's like, you know, I was suggesting something about the duality of man, sir. And the guy just looks so like befuddled by what he's saying.
Yeah. Then you've got like Vincent. Oh my God, I always kill myself when I try to say this guy's name. Vincent D'Onofrio. Yeah. Is that it? Okay. As Private Leonard Gomer Pyle. I just found out like I think like a month ago Gomer Pyle was a character on, I think an old radio show. Griffith show. Is that it? And the only reason I know that is because The Simpsons made a joke about that in like when Homer was looking through his TV guide and then he saw the Andy Griffith show.
Oh, because no. No, it's a sitcom.
It's a sitcom, okay.
From 1964.
And it's about this soldier.
Yeah, it's this romanticizing a soldier who's basically like
Who's
Lenny.
An idiot. Essentially.
But yeah, it's preceded by the Andy Griffith show, and I think it has the same actors.
Yeah, it's got like Andy Griffith, Ron Howard, everybody's favorite Don Knotts. So that's the joke that
kind of flows over your head.
Yeah, you would not know that. Actually, no, this was released in 1987, and the show was still 64? Going on. It stopped in 1968. I'm sorry, I'm usually pretty good with that sort of stuff, but not today. But that's the joke that the Sergeant Hartman is trying to say. Like, I think a lot of people might be thrown off by like Sergeant Harmon and his constant in your face nerd stuff.
But I think that's the point of it.
That is the point. I could not get enough of this guy. Like, I remember watching this movie and like my sister was in the back just like on her computer, and it was, I think she was really put off by just like what the stuff this guy was saying.
But he's underratedly funny. Like,
oh no, Joker, I would have given this guy an Oscar nomination.
Joker is like clearly hilarious throughout the whole film. Like, you know, the interview scenes when his like friend is literally dying, he's like still cracking jokes. And, you know, you've got this guy and he's just basically like, he's the guy who makes Goma Pyle walk around sucking his thumb with his like pants and his ankles. Like, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
He's like really funny guy.
So like Ali Ami was apparently actually a drill instructor and he improvised a lot of this. And, you know, when you're good at something, you might as well just take that through the rest of your life. Because I'm pretty sure, I'm not even sure that if I said this on the podcast.
Yeah, but I mean, he's done essentially only films where he's a policeman.
In Toy Story, he plays the head of the army in that one.
He's in Mississippi Burning, though.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, once you got a role, you might as well just drag that out. He's like Adam West. You might as well just drag that kind of, like, persona
he's
for the rest
Seven.
Of your life. Does he play a drill instructor in Seven?
I didn't know he was in Seven. Oh, he's a police captain. Oh, same shocker.
If I were to check, most of them would have been. And, you know, once you find something that works for you, you just, you know, run that thing into the ground.
Slight pivot. You know, Seven, when it came out, they kept Kevin Spacey off the cast list because people thought it would be too obvious that he would be the villain. And looking back at it, they were not wrong at all. Like, I was watching... I was watching A Time to Kill the other day, and there's a scene in the court where Kevin Spacey gleefully calls someone a racist and groomer and a rapist, like, in front of the entire court.
Oh, sometimes you just watch that, you just go, oh, that one didn't age quite so well.
Ooh,
so, like, the soundtrack for this movie is full of a lot of songs from mid to late 60s.
Weirdly,
I think early 70s.
Weirdly, a lot of surf rock.
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of like Beach Boys-esque.
Yeah, Woolly Bully, Surfing Bird, which I lost my mind when I saw that.
Surfing Bird. The only other, like, I didn't realise that was a real song. So I'd seen the episode where it's a mocking of the Doors of Family Guy. And I thought the Surfing Bird was a Doors song. So when I listened to the Doors, I'm like, where's this song? It's not. It's some random band from the middle.
Yeah, because it does not sound like a real song, you know? And, like, it was so annoying because I'm watching it and it's just watching this serious war film and all I can think of is just Peter Griffin just, like, dancing.
And also just, like, the it's hilarious that they're in these tanks and there's such a goofy song playing. It's
yeah, like I know. We're, like, all this absolute mayhem and destruction and violence is going on around them and you just have, like, the goofiest song, like,
ever
in the background.
Made, like, just...
Yeah, the Rolling Stones, Peter Black. I can't remember when that...
That was the needle drop for the credits.
Ah, I see.
Cool because you have this, like, disastrous Mickey Mouse, and then, like...
Yeah.
Which...
And that, okay, the thing with that ending, and I'm pretty sure this is probably what they were going for, but what I've always thought is that, okay, they end the song with, like, the army singing the Mickey Mouse Club march. The Mickey Mouse Club was a show that was on...
For kids.
Yeah, in the mid, I think, 55, I want to say?
Well,
and
it's been revitalized, obviously.
Yeah, but, like, that specific march was the theme song for that one. It was, like, I think, 55. All of these soldiers... were children when they were watching that show.
I think the idea is there's like two meanings, if you want.
Yeah, well,
like
what do you think?
The return to childhood.
The childhood, that confident thing in this hellhole, this childhood thing, this thing that they enjoyed as they were children, bringing, like, kind of like, it brings them back into something that they know, something they're familiar with in this unfamiliar territory.
Or alternatively, I took it a little bit as it's kind of like, and I think it's quite a key theme of the film, is that war is like adults play. It's what they're like hinting at quite a lot. Because there's all this like Joker is goofing around the whole time. Everyone seems a bit larger than life, a bit stupid. You've got this who is essentially just a baby in Goma Pyle. And it's just kind of this idea that war is man's play.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this, like, bit of a satirical view. They've all got, like, plain mate names. They're all, you know, Eight Ball, Cowboy. They're yeah. all, you know, tick-cracking yeah. jokes. There's not, like, very much seriousness to the characters.
Yeah, until you get to the ending before the Mickey Mouse.
And they kill the sniper. It's kind of...
Yeah, that bit was, like... I don't even know what to say, man.
And like, even there, they like reinforce the team where they're going, you know, hardcore, as if it's kind of like, you know, he's punched someone or something.
Yeah.
Not that he's like actively and when
they find out that the sniper isn't like this fully grown man, it's just this young girl.
And they don't care.
And it's like, it's the kind of thing where like they just have to put it out of a misery at that point. And it's just like, it was great because it was one of those movies that just really make you think.
I think Joker... And I thought,
yeah.
Sorry to circle back.
Yeah, no, go.
I think he's a really well-written character. Definitely. Just in general.
Yeah.
I think he's probably one of the most well-written characters we probably would have covered in the show. And I know a lot of people obviously talk about Arlie Ernie as one of the best actors in the film. And that's true.
And he's always going to be the person you remember because
he's quite poorly written, if you want. Like, not bad.
Not poorly. No, he's obviously like this one dimensional.
It's intentional.
Yeah. There is a reason why, like, in every single TV show or movie where they're ever parodying, like, a war situation or an army situation, they always use this kind of archetype of this drill instructor shouting in your face, because it's such a vivid image of just having this guy absolutely just lose it on your case. Like, what's the bit where like I think like Pyle has like food in his like,
yeah,
oh my god, I quote this thing so many times just because of how funny it is. It's the bit on Christmas Day where they are saying, happy birthday, Jesus.
Yeah, when they're like, all chanting, happy birthday, Jesus.
Happy birthday.
And then, you know, he like mocks them some more and he goes, there'll be a magic show at 2:30. And that's like what we get. That's like a children's thing.
Yeah, but it's just, that's the way you're celebrating Christmas. By saying, this really serious guy just saying, happy birthday, Jesus, is just, I quote that all the time because it's so weird and surreal.
I mean, I would compare this film, and I think it's intentional, or Kubrick has a serious issue with tone. It's kind of like Toy Story in the way that it feels like it's a kid's interpretation of something, but dialed up, if you want. Like, it feels like how a kid would view war, but just, like, with the appropriate violence and stuff.
Yeah.
And you have someone like Joker, who it feels almost like he's trapped in what, kind of like a Groundhog Day thing, mm-hmm. where he can't escape the same scenario over and over, so he's just come to terms with it.
Yeah, that's...
Like, with these jokes about the duality of man, like, he's joking about
that. He's joking in, like, this really, like, horrendous situation. But
that's something really serious to him, that, you know, he doesn't feel like that he can have either.
Yeah. There's this trend. Well, not trend. I wouldn't even say trend. But like, Stanley Kubrick also directed a film in 1957 called Path of Glory.
Yes.
And that is another anti-war film during World War One. So like, there's something, and I would have more to say about this if I knew Kubrick's filmography like the back of my hand, like I do with Spielberg, something like that. But I don't. And I would like to see his other movies just to see, like, because this guy is clearly, I'm not sure, I don't know.
Well, he's done a lot of war movies that are kind of against, there's Barry Lyndon, which isn't so much.
Doctor Strangelove.
Doctor Strangelove. Spartacus. They're not necessarily all wars that we would, like, consider very important, but they do have that theme.
He's got something to say. He's, like, with...
Path of Glory, and then, obviously...
Like, Doctor Strangelove is probably his most obvious...
Anti-war.
...satire of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, you know... And that one is similar to, like, Full Metal Jacket, where it's taking a comedic look at this... kind of horrendous situation, like with the whole Cuban Missile Crisis.
And then the fact that, I don't know if you know how the film ends, but there's this iconic picture. They play We'll Meet Again by Vera Lynn.
Yeah.
And there's this guy, this strange, obscene guy who commanded a nuke. And he's cowboy riding a nuke into the ground.
Yeah, I think most people know that because I think it was like
Mrs. Simpsons.
Yeah, it was. I'm just trying to remember. Was it The Last Temptation of Homer? Yes, that one. Where like he's having like a vision or something like that, and that it's so good because in the original Doctor Strangelove, it's kind of like they use this kind of like blue screen effect on it where you can kind of see that like the guy riding the bomb is kind of like imposed onto a different background. And I love the bit in The Simpsons where it's like they do the same effect where despite it being a cartoon, it looks like it was blue screened on like that. I feel most people know about that ending because like, you know,
that's ending. Quite powerful when you think about it. You've got this "We'll Meet Again," which is famously quite a depressing song with the circumstances it was made for. And it's kind of put into this very ridiculous, like, stupid scene that, like, reflects kind of what Full Metal Jacket is about. Is you've got these guys like Animal Mother, who's just, you're watching it and they're like, he's a great fighter and he's just like spraying bullets everywhere, nothing about it.
Then
he randomly drops a really profound line where he's like, if I'm fighting for a word, it's poontang, because it ain't for freedom, that's for sure. And that's like so depressing that the truth is that loads of soldiers kind of gave up on the cause of Vietnam, but they couldn't go home, so they were just kind of stuck there.
Yeah, what was the bit where like, I think Joker comes up to like the general, I think the general might have been asking like, why you're not fighting? And it's like, oh, the war's over. Like, I can't remember when this movie is set.
It's set a little bit before Vietnam would have ended.
I would guess so.
But there's...
It's weird. It's like, I guess the modern... Like, you know, this is 1987. Vietnam ended, what is it, 73, 74?
Yeah.
It would be like the modern... It's not that far away when this movie is being released. It's like if somebody made a movie with, like, about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
You know, it is actually, that's an even bigger stretch of time, I would say.
But I mean, it has,
it's just interesting to see. You know, it's not as crazy as making Apocalypse Now, like 3 years after the war ends, you know, but
I think there's this weird, it's weird because it happens twice and it feels like a throwaway joke with the prostitutes in Vietnam. To me, it's weird that it happens twice. I think it's supposed to represent something.
Yeah.
But I just don't really...
Can I just say, like, this movie is based on an autobiography.
By?
It's called The Short Timers, and it's about by a U.S. Marines Corps veteran called Gustav Hasford. Gustav also wrote the screenplay for this movie.
Was he Joker?
So it's divided into three sections. One of it is about James T. Joker Davis. It's semi-autobiographical. So Joker wasn't a real person, okay?
Yeah.
These are all made up, but these are based on his own experiences.
With real people.
Yeah. So Joker wasn't a real person, but these are based on the experiences that he had. So all the stuff that you're seeing, it's like... It's similar to like the Fablements. You need to take it with a pinch of salt. Like it is semi-autobiographical. I don't want to say everything and it happened.
Two books. There's The Short Timers, and then there's a secondary one called The Phantom Blooper. Which I believe is.
But this came out after. The Phantom Blooper came out after. This is 1990.
Yeah, this is a separate story. It's about James Joker again.
And,
but
yeah, and it says that he was supposed to make a Vietnam trilogy, but Hasford died. I just want to say, like, looking at like. Again, I really think I haven't properly gotten into Kubrick's filmography. It's a fun, interesting lineup. Like you've got like big Hollywood movies. Like he fits into like every single like era. It's so weird. Like you got big Hollywood movies like Spartacus. Then you've got like new Hollywood era movies like 2001 and A Clockwork Orange.
There is a bit of a like, there is a bit of a fine line there.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of, some of his films are like fun to watch, Full Metal Jacket.
But they really make you think, like A Clockwork Orange or like something like that.
Funny but well made.
Yeah.
And then there's also this element, some of them that are just kind of weird, like Eyes Wide Shut, Clockwork Orange.
And I can only imagine, like, what?
Even The Shining, like, The Shining is a good movie. I enjoy it, but like, what?
Yeah.
And plus, it says it's based on The Shining. And I would argue that it's kind of just names and places.
Really?
The story is, having read the book, really not that similar. It just keeps the beginning, the end, and the character names. And Because
Is that why the Stephen King doesn't like
Stephen
it?
Stephen King hates it.
Yeah, that's probably
the
why.
The book had a lot more supernatural element to it, where there was kind of this that Jack is a reincarnation of one of the original workers. There's this whole story about all of the ghosts of the people who had been killed at the Overlook driving crazy. And Kubrick kind of just touched on that and then cut all of it. And well, it just feels kind of like the film isn't really the book, The Shining. It's just kind of this weird
If you've seen Maximum Overdrive, you know that Stephen King isn't always right about the stuff that he makes.
Yeah, but no, when he's a very talented like, man. Like, when you look at something, well, to write those kind of books.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. A
couple screws.
Yeah, it still boggles my mind that you can write The Shining and The Shawshank
but
Redemption.
When you watch Shawshank Redemption or you watch something like Stand By Me.
Or like The Mist or like...
Not The Mist, oof. Stand By Me. They're like...
Misery.
He is right. Misery. Yeah. He is often very right. They're faithful adaptations, and they're very well done.
Yeah. Going back to Kubrick, I can only imagine like what his version of AI, artificial intelligence, would have looked like.
Weird.
I don't know how far I can imagine, but because like that movie is filled with just like so many like Spielbergian bits in it, and I'm just thinking like what would it have looked like?
I'm willing to bet there's a lot of Eyes Wide Shut just with robots.
Yeah, like as much as Steven Spielberg likes to say that Stanley Kubrick was such a big influence on me. Look at like 2001 Space Odyssey compared to like Close Encounters. It's like he was a very like more nihilistic director, I feel.
We
call
Tarantino freaky for his foot thing, but like Kubrick made Eyes Wide Shut. Like, come on now.
Yeah.
That is just.
And like, he made it like 12 years after like, okay, his last three movies is The Shining.
Banger.
7 years later. He makes Full Metal Jacket. That's a
great
for a director. That's a big stretch of time. Mm. Then you wait 12 years before he makes Eyes Wide Shut.
So he's an old man this time. I mean, he dies before it comes out.
And he just dies in 1999. The movie comes out.
Here's my little fan storyline of what happens. He makes Full Metal Jacket. That's his like opinion on a war that he probably knew a lot about because he was around at that time.
Yeah,
deep, close to his heart. Then he just goes a bit crazy and he's like, they're watching me. All of the people, they're watching me. And then he decides that Eyes Wide Shut is like the reality of
based
the
on
movie
the book?
Business.
I've never seen it. Is it based on the book?
I mean, well, then he was reading some weird stuff, guys. I mean, have you seen the set for how he does it? So do you know the story about Kubrick and England?
No.
He wouldn't leave England. Yeah. He had a fear of planes.
Oh, he died in the county where I was born. That's cool.
So every single shot of every film that he watched since he moved to England, which was just before Shining, was shot in England. So he made, for Eyes Wide Shut, he made massive New York sets with moving screens just so that he could film in England because he was scared of airline waitresses. Like, come on now.
That can't be true.
He's scared of planes.
No, it sounds like...
No, okay, that is true.
Okay, there is an entire Wikipedia page just devoted to the personal life of Stanley Kubrick. I'm not touching that because I know I'm going to open up like a whole bag of... I don't want to... we could probably do a whole podcast on that. I don't know, but the fact that it has an entire Wikipedia page means, oh my God, even on its own page, there's so much. Oh my God.
He's the weirdest director to ever live. Tarantino doesn't come close. And Tarantino is the guy who gave himself a swear word pass in his own movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
but
like,
no, actually, that goes back to Full Metal Jacket. Like, is there?
I feel like they say the derogatory term. I know it's what they said at the time, but like.
No, yeah. Yeah.
Kubrick, there's one where they just like. They're just saying
is it
that word.
Does the prostitute say it? Or was it like...
No.
Was it, no.
The prostitute is borderline racist, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, yeah. The poor guy who's selling it is trying to cover it up. He's like, no soul, brother. That's like...
Yeah, yeah.
Broken, oof.
Yeah.
There's a lot in this movie that's just a bit...
No, I don't care because it's like...
It's quite heavy.
Yeah, no, but I don't care because it is 19...
Yeah,
I didn't even
it feels like a Ricky Gervais stand-up show. Whereas there's a whole lot of like, oh, this is really funny. Should he have said that?
Yeah,
ooh,
but
that's
it's different when like you're actually doing it from the time period and you're like...
But for example, we have to talk about it. The actual Full Metal Jacket scene itself, where they kill the instructor, Gunnery's killed.
Jesus, that bit was just...
That watching that,
I was. I think I actually stopped that, and I turned to my sister, who I knew wouldn't care. But I was like, "Look at how Stanley Kubrick directs, like symmetry, and like it's this beautiful. Guy loves his tiles." I just want to say,
it's beautiful, but oh my lord,
like oh my god,
like Vince I love how
vivid, yeah, I love how vivid the red is, like the red, like
yeah, Full Metal Jacket, and then he sits down, he stares the guy who's tried his life to keep him alive in this camp in the eyes, and then blows them off. And Jesus. Unlike most directors who would cut away for that,
I know.
You're watching that down.
I know, and it's just like, for me, it was just kind of put me like it kind of like took me by surprise. Where like they don't ever draw attention to it again.
Yeah, because
there is
yeah, so there's
nothing after that. From there, you are going straight into the war, and I guess it's kind of emblematic of like. That's how in the war, like, people just on. Die.
Yeah.
People just
they do that
die.
A lot in the film where people just. But I think it's one of the filmmaking techniques that introduced me the most. Interests me the most. I don't think this is a perfect example of it, but smash cut, which is when you go from one thing to a vastly different thing, like, instantly. They use it in Sound of Metal. They tell him, you know, you've got to preserve what's left of your hearing because you don't have very much. And then you're straight into him at a heavy metal concert. They do the same thing here. He's watching this guy die, and then boom, they're straight into Vietnam. He's got his hair back now. There's prostitutes. Like, yeah. He's just doing this kind of thing. And then, you know, throughout the film, there's loads of people who just kind of die. And then you have this kind of like virtual smash cut, if you want, where it doesn't actually do it, but you just bam, like you're straight into the next thing. Like, you know, there's this scene where they're all dying and they're all talking. And then Joker cracks a joke and they all just keep on moving. And that's kind of it. Or there's this bit, you know, where there's a dead Vietnamese man next to them. And he's like, it's his birthday today. And it's like really sadistic thing. And
is it this part?
Yeah.
Ah, I see.
With the pictures where he's like, you want a good picture? Take a picture of this.
What?
And it's all this really dark stuff.
What do they call them in this movie?
I don't know if we're allowed to say it.
It's a term that I have never heard.
I haven't heard outside of Vietnam.
I have not heard outside of this movie.
I
have
Vietnam
no
movies.
Clue how bad of a connotation it is.
Yes,
I think it's best
to
leave it.
But if you've seen Full Metal Jacket or you've seen
you
the
know
Vietnam,
what it, you know what
you
it
know
is.
What we're talking
and,
about. I'm guessing it is.
I'm guessing it is.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a wild swing.
Just take
there.
It safe there.
Yeah. Okay.
They say it so much in this movie. It's just like every seventh word.
Again, like I give leeway when it's not just this is 1987. But it's also like it's supposed to be set.
Yeah, it's like Black Klansman. Like,
This is the time period. This is the thing. You know, I'm expecting. I'm definitely expecting this.
Get along with that.
Yeah. So, the music was done by I'm seeing somebody called Vivian Kubrick. So I'm gonna take a wild guess. It was
his wife.
Youngest daughter of Kubrick. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Not wife. I hope not, Kubrick.
No. You made that mistake. That's no. I guess this is the kind of movie that probably. So, in terms of how it did, it received positive reviews. Okay. It was made for for 1987, it is genuinely a pretty small, like $16.5 to $30 million. That's
not bad.
That's as a budget. That's.
And you want to guess how much that went into keeping it in England?
We have to find a way to issue this.
England.
I would doubt. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. No, you're right. Jesus.
That's why in the training scenes, which are supposed to be in kind of California, America, everything looks too green and too cold.
Yeah.
Because it's literally in Kubrick's backyard. Like.
The
Vietnam scenes.
Filmed
I don't know.
In Cambridge?
That's why you never really see a scene in Vietnam where they're, you know, like in Forrest Gump, there's this great scene where he's running out with all the people and you see all the foliage.
Yeah.
They never have a scene like that.
Yeah,
it's always,
always
buildings or like landscapes that can easily be done with like a blowtorch and
stuff. You know what you've just done? You made me really interested in Stanley Kubrick right now. I already kind of was, but like this guy just like seems just.
He's a badass, but he's a weird,
like
badass.
An insane, like absolutely insane
that costs
guy.
Like at least $5 million a movie to do that. And people were just like, yeah, that's all right.
Yeah, like, you know, it definitely would have cost so much little
like
if
Shining.
He just shot on location.
The Shining was shot in...
Well, I remember it was shot in the hotel that they go to in Dumb and Dumber. That's all like around.
He built that hotel and they broke it down after being built.
Wait, actually...
And the hotel...
We're going to go on a tangent there and find that out. Like,
I'm pretty sure that they didn't... actually use all of what they built in the Overlook. And also, he didn't like some of the stuff that they built, so they had to bring it all back. No, that's Blade Runner, sorry. Where they built it, and he says these pillars should be the other way around. And so they had to unbuild the whole thing and replace the pillars.
Yeah, the Timberling Lodge, it's still around.
Some of it, but yeah. The facade was entirely the Overlook. They built that.
I don't even know where I found out it was shot, like Dumb and Dumber was shot there, but I'm pretty sure, I'm pretty sure it was.
That's why in Ready Player One, when they return to The Shining, it's slightly off. Like the ballroom isn't the same as in the film.
Isn't it all just digital, I swear?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. That's the excuse, but it's because most of the set no longer exists.
Really? Yeah, so with this movie...
Because the Timberland Hotel, if you search it up...
Yeah.
Won't look...
I thought it looked pretty similar.
The facade won't be the same. Because they built the facade and some of the rooms custom made.
Really?
The exterior shots is the Timberline Hotel. Some of the interior ones are custom built.
Okay, that's fine. This movie made $120 million, so clearly a lot of people watched it, which is great, because it's a great movie.
Is it with the cast of this and Jurassic Park?
Who else?
Howard, the cowboy guy, is in the second Jurassic Park movie. He's one of the bad guys in the second Jurassic Park movie.
Wait, who does he play in this one?
He plays... Oh, he's Cowboy in Full Metal Jacket. Yeah, he plays Peter Ludlow, the son of Hammond. Fun fact.
I love that you just learned the lore of the Jurassic Park movies.
It's not my fault. That's
something that you just... It's like learning the lore to the three Jaws sequels. Good movies, but you gotta respect somebody for going to the effort to remember this.
I've watched
stuff.
Almost every single one apart from the last one.
Yeah, you don't need to touch that. Everybody did, but
So apparently he's in Moneyball as well. Yeah, he is. He's really? John Henry in Moneyball, so he's one of the other owners. By the way, Moneyball, Oscars guys. Moneyball is it can have a couple of Oscars.
They weren't going to nominate that.
They didn't win that much.
I didn't even get nominated. It
could have. I mean, have you seen it?
Oh, no. I'm sure it was a great film.
It was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, Best Picture, Best Actor.
Oh, Moneyball. The one with, what's his face? Jonah Hill.
Have you actually watched it?
No, I haven't.
No,
I wasn't saying it's bad. It just didn't ring me as
it's
the kind of movie.
It's probably the greatest sports film ever made. Definitely the greatest baseball film. And it's not even actually about baseball, really. It's about running a business.
Yeah.
And losing a whole lot.
Yeah.
And then being a horrible guy and betraying your team for more money.
Oh my god, I didn't even realise Vincent D'Onofrio plays Orson Welles and Ed Wood. I should have known that.
I didn't realise he was actually an actor. I thought he just did.
No, he's been in so much stuff. And he is one of the actors who I always see the name. And I'm like, oh, it's that guy. Where do I know him from? Can't remember. Okay, moving on then.
The Magnificent Seven, Law and Order, Men in Black.
He plays Edgar in He plays Edgar in
Men in Stealing, Adventures in Babysitting, The Godfather of Harlem, Mystic Pizza, The Kid. This guy really just, if someone gives him
I think he's a character actor.
The old businessman, apart from this movie.
Wait, can I just ask? Is Vincent D'Onofrio supposed to be, overweight in this movie?
Yes. That's the whole point. Why they call him a fat ass pile.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Because apparently he's also in Adventures of Babysitting, which is a movie I've got quite a bit of a soft spot for. And it came out the same year. Look what he looks like in that.
Oh my. Holy.
And I'm so confused. How do you do that in the same year?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I would
just want to put I like that. I like that movie.
I would say though, sorry, this is the best example of, I don't know if you've heard of The 7 Degrees. Of Kevin Bacon originally. Mm-hmm. This episode is just that. It's one movie to the next, and we've ended up on.
No, because we've said everything. Okay, have we said the movie got a best adapted screenplay nomination?
Or win?
I can't remember which one.
Wait, I think I can do 7 Degrees and end up with
Nomination. Yeah.
Harakiri. The movie about the Japanese suicide. Never mind, we got back to Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai. That's where all everything goes. Is that actually any good? No. Yet again, another random American actor who turns out to be a samurai.
Pretty much.
It has almost exactly... Billy Connolly. Connolly.
Wait, what's he doing in that?
And Timothy Spall.
Wait, no, actually, back up. What movie is this called?
The Last Samurai.
What is Peter Pettigrew doing in that movie?
No, no, Billy Connolly is not Peter
Pettigrew. No, Timothy Spall. Billy Connolly, isn't he...
He's the dad in Brave.
No, he is Uncle... What's it? Uncle Monty in the series Unfortunate Events. Oh, I love him in that one.
Oh, my Lord. This is insane.
How do we get to a series Unfortunate Events from here?
Oh,
We've touched on, like, 10 movies.
Wow. Okay, hold on. Quickly, can we just, like, wrap up this episode?
Okay. I love this movie.
I love this movie.
I gave it 5 stars.
Four and a half stars.
So if I would, I would have...
4.5 stars.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, go and watch it. Yeah. Joker's hilarious. The writing is great. Stanley Kubrick's a bit weird. Loads of really impactful stuff that we touched on.
It is in AFI's, the American Film Institute.
Yeah,
100 years, 100 thrills, which I think most exciting.
Go
movies.
Watch it.
So yeah,
and we will be doing an episode that's just us going off target for the whole episode.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Yeah. We'll see you next time with The Godfather. Bye.
Yeah. Oh, you teased it. Okay.